for at least two of us, this is a mutual admiration society because at different points in our career, few decades, we both have worked for Mr. Dean Rusk. We're delighted to have with us on this rainy day Dr. Dorinda G. Dalmeyer, who is the research director of the Dean Rusk Center for International and Comparative Law. She's served in this capacity for 6 years following her graduation with distinction from the University of Georgia Law School. She was executive articles editor for the Georgia Law Review and was also named Woman of the Year by the Georgia Association of Women Lawyers. She holds her Bachelor's of Science and Master's of Science degrees in geology from the University of Georgia. Indeed, if she had picked another husband, she probably might have gone on with that field because it was her interest. But since her husband is a professor in geology, she decided that any trace of nepotism ought to be avoided. And so she launched out into the field of international and comparative law, where she's already distinguished herself. Among her publications are Strategic Defense, New Perspectives on Deterrence, The Dynamics of Arms Control, Hiroshima to the Year 2000, and Rights to Oceanic Resources, Deciding and Drawing Maritime Boundaries. She's also written numerous articles and papers on various topics. We originally had thought of the title, The INF Treaty as a Paradigm for Arms Control. That won't be neglected. But as we talked this morning, the topic, the hidden costs of arms control seemed to be one of the topics that it would be well worth talking about. If you have some competition, why you it's not from critics of arms control, but it's just when it's raining, the builders come indoors and work right next to us. And I'm sure you've handled worse things in the past.
More hostile crowds. Well, we can pretend that they're building a new world order on the port. Before I begin, I want to say how delighted I am to be with you today. I know very well the works of the Miller Center, primarily through the series on arms control. We've had people who have contributed to that series take part in our conferences, and over the last 6 years, some of those people have become my close working colleagues. So I am delighted and flattered to be here with you today. What I want to talk about, as Dr. Thompson indicated, is for the intriguing title of The Hidden Costs of Arms Control. It comes out of a project I've been carrying on the last 18 months under the auspices of the grants program of the MacArthur Foundation to look at the INF Treaty as a model for future arms control. We've had some developments in that area over the last 18 months, so most particularly with the upcoming CFE treaty, or the ratification of the CFE treaty, and also the ratification of the test ban protocols, which went into effect this year. So what I want to focus on today is the START agreement, which is still under negotiation, and discuss a new issue, that is the cost of conducting arms control monitoring and verification. The INF Treaty has provided us 2 years of experience with an extremely intrusive verification regime. And so today what I'd like to do is draw on the experience we can gain from INF to see how that might affect the costs and the operational aspects of implementing START. To review just briefly, the INF Treaty signed between the United States and the Soviet Union in 1988 was a very simple idea and very straightforward, at least at first glance. It was the total ban on ground-launched missiles of ranges between 500 and 5,500 kilometers. The missiles were to be eliminated along with the launchers, transporters, and various types of support facilities by June 1st of next year. Also, production of these missiles and flight testing was banned in perpetuity. But something that was as simple as this sounds is actually more difficult to monitor for a number of reasons. First of all, the INF missiles were relatively small, they were mobile, easy to conceal, unlike the missile silos and bombers and submarines, which, even though the submarines are harder to detect when they're on patrol, they're still quite visible to national technical means of verification, the reconnaissance satellites primarily, and also carry a finite number of missiles and warheads. Many of these intermediate range missiles could be armed with either nuclear warheads or conventional warheads, with no way to tell simply from external observation which one they carried. Finally, the mobile launchers for cruise missiles could be reloaded, although at a fairly slow pace. Nevertheless, because of the reload capability, both sides had to know how many spares were available. Now, because of these factors, there was uncertainty on both sides exactly about the numbers of the missiles in the opposing arsenal. Also, it meant that the United States and Soviet Union could no longer rely exclusively on their reconnaissance satellites, the national technical means of verification, to monitor the adherence to the treaty. So in INF, we had to have more intrusive forms of verification and inspection to get the complete picture. So as a consequence, INF provided for five types of on-site inspections, where inspectors actually go to the sites to determine various things. First were baseline inspections. These were used to verify the number of missiles in the arsenal, and also to provide information about the missile facilities and the missiles themselves. There was a document called the Memorandum of Understanding, which contained site diagrams of all the missile, of all 164 missile bases and support facilities that were listed therein. These inspections took place during the first 3 months that the treaty went into force, after the treaty went into force. And although the INF treaty may not have accomplished much in terms of the numbers of weapons that it did away with, you should remember that the types of information exchanged in this Memorandum of Understanding formally would have been considered espionage. A second type of inspection were closeout inspections, where when a missile base or support facility ends its service, then inspectors have the right to go and verify that indeed these activities have stopped. The third type of inspection was the elimination inspection, which gives inspectors from both sides the opportunity to observe the destruction of missiles and launchers and transporters. A fourth type was the short notice inspection, which gives both sides the opportunity to conduct a quota each year, certain number of inspections on very short notice, which means essentially being able to declare an inspection and get to the site within 8 hours after that declaration. For the first 3 years that the INF treaty is in force, both sides will have the opportunity to conduct 20 short notice inspections. Then the quota drops to 15 for the next 5 years, and then for the final 5 years of the treaty, that is from 1996 to the year 2001, they will have the opportunity to conduct 10 short notice inspections. And then the final type of on-site inspection is called portal monitoring of production facilities, What this means is that both sides conduct 24-hour-a-day monitoring of one side in the other country. In the Soviet Union, this is in the town of Votkinsk, where we have inspectors sitting in a small command post at the portal of a former SS-20 missile facility to observe that SS-20 missiles are no longer being produced there. In the United States, the Soviets have a counterpart opportunity at the Hercules missile motor production facility in Magna, Utah, which is near Salt Lake City. Now, to memorialize these monitoring requirements, the INF Treaty now consists of five parts. There's the treaty itself, which sets forth the basic 17 articles, the basic obligations of the two parties. There's a protocol on inspections, which gives detailed procedures for carrying out these inspection opportunities. A protocol on elimination, which is appropriately enough, sort of the Vegematic part of the treaty, which gives in great detail exactly how these missiles are to be sliced, diced, and julienned into oblivion. The Memorandum of Understanding, which I mentioned earlier, which contains all of the information about site diagrams, facilities, and then finally a portion of the agreement called the Memorandum of Agreement, I'm sorry, which was concluded last year in December, which describes in even greater detail the operational aspects of implementing the treaty. The treaty plus the two protocols runs about 56 pages. The Memorandum of Understanding is 170 pages long, and the Memorandum of Agreement 137 pages long, a total of 370 pages of documentation to get rid of 2,692 missiles, or less than 4% of the U.S. and Soviet arsenals. You can compare this with the SALT I agreement, an ABM treaty signed in the early 1970s, which together totaled only about 25 pages. So arms control is becoming a much more complex enterprise than it has been in the past. Part of the reason for this level of detail can be attributed to demands within the Reagan administration and from persons in Congress that any treaty with the Soviet Union be effectively verifiable. And the idea of effective verification was chosen to contrast with that proposed for SALT II, which provided for adequate verification. Effective was seen as representing a higher level of assurance or a more demanding level of verification. However, in subsequent testimony, Ambassador Glickman revealed that there was really not that much difference between the two. Nevertheless, this demand for extremely intrusive verification is introducing complexities into negotiations that few diplomats are traditionally equipped to handle. There are two sides to this coin of detail. If one goes toward increased specificity, you run the risk of creating loopholes where you fail to anticipate future developments or fail to include coverage for items which differ only slightly from the specifics that you provide. For example, during the ratification process in the Senate, there was some question about whether the INF Treaty would cover futuristic weapons similar in range to the INF weapons that would be banned by the treaty. On the other hand, with lack of specificity, you run into a different type of problem, such as we've seen over the ABM treaty and the discussion of the Krasnoyarsk radar. In the ABM treaty, it states that these radars are only to be built on the periphery of the country, but nowhere in the ABM treaty does it define what periphery consists of. Qualitatively, the location of this radar hundreds of kilometers inland would seem to defy the notion of peripheral. But nevertheless, that is a problem an issue which did not arise at the time of negotiation, which later came back to haunt both sides. So specificity or the lack thereof can be equally problematic. Nevertheless, in INF, these requirements for very detailed monitoring of compliance puts a lot of pressure on the practicality of the treaty. I think you can get a sense of that simply from the length of the treaty. Indeed, the two sides engaged in very long negotiations beginning before the treaty actually was ratified in the Senate and then intensified during the period leading up to its implementation to discuss things such as the actual questions about the actual measurements provided by one side, which the other side thought were incorrect, questions about what kind of photographic angles would be used to take pictures of missiles, extending to questions such as the types of codes to be used to identify the military transport planes carrying inspectors, the types of binoculars the inspectors could use, how many spare batteries they could bring for their flashlights, and the size and shape of the luggage tags on the inspector's baggage. And this is all now incorporated into the memorandum of agreement. Now, we can't say that we should have expected either side to have seen this coming. At least on the United States side, prior to INF, there was really not much experience with on-site inspection. Of course, the United States participates in the International Atomic Energy Agency inspection protocol, which is set up to ensure that nuclear materials are not diverted. However, much of the day-to-day monitoring under the Non-Proliferation Treaty is carried out by means of surveillance cameras, not people visiting sites. Inspections under the Antarctic Treaty were set up to ensure that continent remains demilitarized are carried out on a rather informal basis. And even the data exchanges and observations that we agreed to between NATO and the Warsaw Treaty countries under the Conference on Disarmament in Europe do not occur with the day-to-day frequency that inspections supporting INF occur. Now, the experience gained in implementing such a complex document as the INF Treaty is beginning to indicate that on-site inspections can become a significant management and financial undertaking. As one of your speakers described it, someone who was here back in September, Paula Scalingi said that the former attitude of the negotiators was negotiate now, worry about the costs later. Now INF, with its introduction of so many new forms of inspection, has added a new twist, only the roughest estimates of costs could be forecast. In terms of the management issues, under the INF Treaty, each party is allowed up to 600 inspectors. There are 200 to handle the 24-hour-a-day production monitoring, up to that many on the list anyway. A second list of inspectors to carry out the remaining four types of inspections, and a third list of aircrew personnel to ferry these people around the countryside. If you visit the on-site inspection agency at Dulles, and go into their communications center, they have a wall-sized television display simply to keep up with where inspections are going on in the two countries, what types of inspections are going on, and an update of the exact status on things such as missile elimination. On the financial side, the on-site inspection agency bears the cost for preparations for inspections, such as training and equipping the inspectors, and the actual costs of inspections themselves. They also have to pay the salaries for inspections. On the other hand, there are additional costs not included in their budget, such as the salaries for personnel that have been seconded to the agency from other branches of government, and the costs of airlift. They also, in their budget, do not cover the costs of activities in support of INF which are conducted by other agencies, in most particular the intelligence agencies, which although on-site inspections have added a great deal to the amount of information that we have, we nevertheless still must continue to monitor and analyze information pertaining to INF missiles through the National Technical Means of Verification. In addition, there are other departments in the executive branch which conduct research and development activities in support of verification technologies, such as the Defense Nuclear Agency, the Department of Energy, and even the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency itself has its own research budget. Outside of government, on-site inspection places burdens on defense contractors who happen to be subject to these inspections. There may be costs due to changing security plans at facilities subject to now the short notice inspections, such as increase in the number of security guards, relocating sensitive activities to other facilities, and lost production time if the facilities are shut down during an inspection. For example, at the Middle River, Maryland plant that belongs to Martin Marietta, when they are subject to a short notice inspection, they send all the workers home, they remove all the nameplates from the doors so that no one walking down a hall can simply determine what's going on in an office or room by looking at the door, and they rekey all the door locks so that the inspectors have access to the facility with one master key. And estimates, at least from the early implementation of this types of inspection there, was that each time they had to do this, it cost about $5 million, which of course is passed on to the taxpayer. As you might expect, the cost of this 24-hour-a-day monitoring at production facilities is high also. At Votkinsk, where the U.S. inspectors are located, the monitoring equipment consists of a complex assortment of infrared sensors, radiation detectors, surveillance cameras, as well as a sophisticated X-ray system which can look inside freight cars to determine that missiles inside canisters are not SS-20 missiles banned by the treaty, but perhaps other types of missiles that are still produced there. The Soviet inspectors at Utah have different monitoring demands and use much less complicated equipment. Nevertheless, the Utah facility had to be sequestered from other portions of that plant, which meant putting in 10,000 meters of fencing, 1,000 meters of paved road, 1,000 meters of unpaved road, and all of this had to be done within 60 days after the treaty went into force. And those of you who have experience with government contracting can only wonder at how that managed to be done. Now, I had been on this was something that had come up as a sidelight. My original research focus was not to look at costs of INF so much, but this kept coming up, the costs of implementing this treaty. And I had been going through a treasure hunt through the government trying to figure out what the costs were. And then finally in September of this year, the Congressional Budget Office has gotten me out of the defense economist role in that they published estimates of implementation costs for INF and then projected costs for future agreements. It's a The report itself presented estimates for the one-time procedures like eliminating missiles, closing facilities, the cost of conducting these closeout inspections, how to establish this 24-hour-a-day monitoring, as well as projections for recurring procedures, the short-notice inspections that will take place for 13 years until 2001, the portal monitoring, and also the day-to-day management. They also, fortunately, were working, as I was, with unclassified data, so I was gratified to when I read that they had given about the same range of costs that I was able to come up with. Their estimate was that the one-time costs, the cost of setting up the various types of procedures, and over the first 3 years that the INF Treaty was in force, is between $300 million to $520 million. And each year after that, until the year 2001, when all systems will be considered eliminated and totally banned, the annual cost will be between $35 and $75 million a year. Now, I thought it was interesting that even though they do have these figures, that we have 2.5 years of experience with INF, that still we have a rather wide range in what the actual costs would be. Part of this uncertainty could be attributed to the fact that CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, also only had access to unclassified data. But it does serve as a reminder that extrapolating costs for future agreements may be more difficult than you might expect at first. It also should be noted that these costs do not cover the costs for the continuing monitoring by the intelligence agencies by means of satellites, and then all the analysis that goes into that. However, regardless of the uncertainty in the figures, they do serve to underscore the idea that today intrusive inspection is expensive and the costs continue for the duration of the treaty. Now, if I can turn briefly to prognostications about START, there and start anticipating the reduction of arsenals over a 7-year period to reach a ceiling of 6,000 warheads with limits on delivery vehicles. Moving toward these reductions is not going to be as simple as it was in START, primarily because START represents limits rather than a total ban. If you completely ban certain type of missiles, as you had in INF, you have to eliminate things such as the testing facilities, the production facilities. It makes it much more simple to determine noncompliance. All you need to find is one missile, and that's an unequivocal indication of noncompliance. Limits like we have in START will require a much closer accounting, not of the larger things such as bombers or silos or submarines, but of smaller items such as the number of warheads on missiles, of non-deployed or spare missiles stored inside buildings out of the view of satellites, of mobile missiles, which are intrinsically much more difficult and it seems more highly desired simply because they are so difficult to locate. And then the extremely tough problem of sea-launched cruise missiles, which the United States and Soviet Union have agreed just to put off from this negotiation entirely. Also, both sides are pursuing qualitative restrictions on weapons, such as distinguishing nuclear-armed heavy bombers from non-nuclear-armed heavy bombers. And these serve to complicate monitoring tasks. In all their 12 depending on how you divide it up, 12 or 13 types of inspections viewed as desirable and necessary for monitoring START, which will have to be accommodated in the START treaty text, which currently runs over 500 pages long. We will, in START, have the same types of baseline inspections, closeout inspections, short notice inspections, elimination inspections, and continuous monitoring of production facilities. To respond to these unique requirements that START presents, the two sides have agreed to add new forms of on-site inspection. Indeed, they've already begun to provide what are called technical observations, where already this year we have had Soviet inspectors at the submarine base at St. Mary's palpating the number of warheads atop a submarine-launched ballistic missile to determine that the various types of missiles carry only a limited number or a set number of warheads. We also are having technical exhibitions of bombers and land-based ballistic missiles as well. Now, as I mentioned earlier, mobile missiles are going to have to be subject to some sorts of inspections. This may include things such as tagging and opportunities to actually check the numbers of mobile missile launchers on the ground. And then we may have also, as a new aspect of short notice inspection, the opportunity to inspect not just some list of facilities, but any suspicious site in either country. Originally, this was proposed in INF, but is it within the administration, some counsel that the Soviet Union might abuse its privilege to inspect anytime, any place in the United States. And in INF, the decision was made to back away from that. However, in START, there may be a certain number of inspections allowed at certain types, at some types of facilities with no right of refusal, and then other types of facilities with a right to refuse inspection, but requiring that the other side alleviate the concerns about that facility. Now, uncertainties as we go into the final stages of this negotiation, that's when you start encountering the difficult, the real questions, the things that people don't want to budge from. And so uncertainties remain regarding a number of the details on START, such as the length and frequency of inspection and the types of equipment that will be used. Nevertheless, the Congressional Budget Office in its report went on to attempt to project what costs would be for monitoring START as well. And according to their figures, these one-time costs, the costs of implementing the treaty over 7 years, of eliminating weapons and facilities, and the management costs would range between $410 million to $1.8 billion over 7 years. They were able to use many of the same numbers that had been generated for INF to give them estimates for things such as inspections of bases and other types of facilities, and also observing elimination. Costs increase for START, however, in terms of elimination of equipment, because it may be much more complex to eliminate some of the types of items that will be destroyed to reach the START ceiling. The costs of developing tagging apparatus to keep a close account of the number of treaty-limited items, and also preparations to monitor the production facilities. They estimate also that the recurring annual costs will range from about $100 million to $390 million, nearly four times their estimates for INF. And this is probably due in large part to the greater number of facilities that will be subject to this production monitoring. And INF, there's only one in each country. In START, there may be as many as four. Also, there are going to be costs that will have to come from direct budget outlays. Portal monitoring, for example, will have to come outside of the existing military budget. Some of the costs that could be contributed by the existing military budget would be the cost for the military personnel to conduct inspections, and also some of the duties could be taken over by military personnel currently assigned to other roles and missions. So there will have to be, apparently from their estimates, some additional outlays that cannot be absorbed by the existing budget. So what does this lead me to conclude? It's obvious that the rights to on-site inspection have given new impetus to the pursuit of arms control agreements, but we should remember that the ultimate objective for a verification is to confirm compliance, and through it to lead to increased confidence by political leaders on both sides that the agreement they've entered into has value. Inspections really should not be pursued as an end in themselves, but rather should be used only to the extent necessary to confirm compliance with treaty mandates. The parties have to decide what it really is they need to know to protect their national security. And perhaps they should take the words of Winston Churchill, who was certainly not noted as a pacifist, who said, "When I look back on all these worries and suspicions, I remember the old man who said that he had had a lot of trouble in his life, most of which never happened." The United States in particular is captive of the worst case scenario. We can dream up the absolute worst case for every type of non-compliance imaginable, and some that are imaginable only by the most facile of minds. Now we are obviously facing a growing federal deficit that's second only to the defense budget and spending priorities. We have to determine if the costs of these inspections are justifiable in terms of the deficit and other needs that have to be met. While we have to ensure that the parties are negotiating technically sound agreements, policymakers have to realize that often the best that they can do is anticipate and influence forces for change, not control them. A couple of years ago, the Soviet academician Vitaly Galdansky suggested that we were moving from mutual assured destruction as a means of deterrence to deterrence by verification. Maybe this is just an uncomfortable adolescence that the two countries have to go through in their relationship with each other. Perhaps as mutual confidence builds between the United States and the Soviet Union, we'll be able to move beyond this habitual focus on the worst case scenario, which is in part responsible for a phase of extremely intrusive verification procedures. Monitoring and verification are, of course, will never be as expensive to pursue as an arms race, but the price tag is beginning to rise. And at least for the near term, Mr. Shevardnadze may have summed it up best when he said, we will continue for a long time to pay this ransom of mutual mistrust. So I think I'll leave it at that, and I'd be delighted to answer any questions that you may have.
May I ask one or two questions?
Surely.
I can remember Mr. Rusk talking in percentages at one time. You know, there were a certain percentage of nuclear instruments that one could hide in caves and places like that, mm-hmm. and we couldn't be therefore sure about more than 70%, 80%, 90%. Is there any talk of that kind in arms control regimes that absolute certainty is ruled out, but that if we can monitor 60, 80, 90%, whatever it is, that's pretty good? Or has that way of thinking been abandoned?
I don't know that people are speaking so much in percentages. Certainly there's always the question of hidden caches of weapons, which is usually met by the counter-argument that in order for them to be usable, that party that has these weapons hidden would have to maintain a completely covert training operation with those missiles. They couldn't be tested because those would be easily detectable, and that if they were trying to produce them covertly, then they would have to have a completely separate production and hidden transportation and a very complex thing to carry out that would be undetectable. I think the one thing which I was surprised at, I believe it was about 5 or 6 months ago, apparently someone from the Joint Chiefs gave as a percentage that it would have to be something like 30 or 40% beyond what they were supposed to have in order for them to be concerned. But I think people have gotten away from at least numerical percentages and are talking more in terms of militarily significant. And maybe that's an even lower, it's probably lower than effective verification. In whatever numerical ideas that conjures up. But I think the focus now is on the military significance of being able to detect a militarily significant capability by means of various, either by on-site inspection or by national technical means of verification. So I'm not aware of anybody really talking in percentages. I think it depends on the type of weapon system you're talking about.
The other question was, what happens with the 10,000 nuclear weapons scattered around in the 15 Soviet republics? You probably saw the statement by General Yazov over the weekend that the central government was going to bear down now more and more on control of the military and keeping it in the hands of the central government. But mm-hmm. A, is that likely? And B, what do arms control people say about monitoring, identifying, and generally controlling weapons that are scattered among the republics?
Well, we had a similar situation in INF in that there were a number of basing countries that both the United States and the Soviet Union had. Under the terms of that agreement, all of the bases were subject to inspection, both the baseline inspections. They were subject to closeout inspections to ensure that when the United States removed its missiles, say, from Greenham Commons in England, then Soviet inspectors could go there and verify the the closeout of those activities, and also short notice inspections. And so I think there'd be a similar type of arrangement that all facilities, regardless of which of the Soviet republics they're located in, are going to come under this type of inspection. What this is more or less an internal security problem for the Soviet Union. I think that they would probably be delighted to have the weapons in the safest possible hands, given what's going on there now. There have been movements of strategic weapons and out of these areas of unrest to other facilities that were more secure.
Colonel Foote, we always end up cutting you off at the end of the meeting. If you have any question in the beginning, why, now's the time or forever hold your peace.
I have one. Is there anybody subject to this treaty other than the Soviets and the United States? What about all these other countries that are reported to have the common?
The START agreement itself will only cover the United States and the Soviet Union as signatories to that. The Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty is really the avenue by which to bring others in to the both the countries which have nuclear capability and also those which perhaps have it, and then the ones that have forsworn the acquisition of nuclear weapons capability. But START is between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Henry Thielberg.
What I derive from what you just said is that from a practical standpoint, we're stalled here at the START level, because if you were to go beyond that, you'd have almost a geometrical increase in the inspection demands, which from a practical standpoint would seem almost impossible unless there's some major resolution of this complexity that you outlined.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that, from a practical standpoint, aren't we up against really a closeout beyond study?
Well, if there's any hope in the matter, perhaps we could draw it from CFE, in that we, in that agreement, although we have similar types of intrusive inspection, we have not gone to the extreme of wanting to keep up with each and every piece of equipment down to the nth degree. Originally, the mutual and balanced force reductions negotiations, which went on for years and years and years, were focusing on count on troops, on trying to count troop numbers. And the idea of trying to keep up with all these people was just an incredible accounting job. There were even proposals to put tags on people that could be monitored in some remote fashion. I guess it's really a difference in perhaps attributable to the different psychological view of nuclear weapons as opposed to conventional weapons. It may be more difficult to get down further and further simply because of the difference in the quality of the destructive power of nuclear weapons versus conventional weapons. Also the issue of how to bring in other nuclear weapons states into this agreement is a big problem. At what point do we start trying to bring in the Chinese or addressing the British or the French in reducing their weapons as well? So we're going to have to see how START works out, but it's going to be an incredibly long and complex agreement.
Victor Yonke and then Bill Wemple.
What do the initials CFB stand for? Is that relating to Europe?
Conventional Forces in Europe. Yes, sir. Sorry.
Bill Wemple.
Very roughly, what part of the cost you were talking about would be our cost of monitoring the Soviets by our side?
Yes, sir.
Contrasted with
okay. Fortunately, I have those numbers pretty much broken down. In terms of eliminating U.S. equipment under START, that means eliminating our Poseidon submarines and various types of missiles, these are very large ranges from 260 million to about 1.1 billion. Now that's just for U.S. equipment.
That's for eliminating.
Yes, sir.
Not the inspecting and.
No, sir.
I was thinking of getting things arranged for the Soviets.
Okay.
To do
all right.
Inspecting.
Okay. For the costs for the United States to host the Soviet inspections, like the baseline inspections, closeout inspections, these technical characteristics where they come and look at missiles. Congressional Budget Office estimates that between $5 and $25 million to prepare U.S. facilities for Soviet monitoring of production. These four facilities, 24 hours a day, between $60 to $350 million.
To do what?
To monitor, to set up four sites for the Soviets to monitor 24 hours a day.
In the United
States. In the United States.
You mean to add that on?
Yes, sir.
Plus
350.
Yeah.
That's the top end.
Mm-hmm.
So that's about 375.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other things that are not broken down between the United States and the Soviet Union,
right.
Things like planning and management, yeah. Research and development.
But the other is then our team, our expenses, costs of our team
to go
to this.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And that $375 million was just the one-time cost for us on a yearly basis to go to the Soviet Union to conduct short notice inspections, suspect site inspections, and to have our people sitting at four sites in the Soviet Union monitoring their production facilities. That would probably be, adding up those things here, would probably run about $85 million a year, plus whatever management costs go along with that.
So we spend several times on dealing with our own facilities and inspections to satisfy this congressional passion.
Mm-hmm.
Passion for verification.
Well,
than what we have to spend to verify what the Soviets are doing. Now, if the Soviets have to trade teams and rotate them for fear that they will get co-opted and defect and get to love the U.S., so they have to bring them back every short time and send some new ones, does that materially increase our costs of trying to accommodate their inspections, or maybe it's impossible to say?
No, sir, I don't think that that really makes it that much of a difference one way or the other, because the Soviet inspectors that I visited with out in Utah, there was the one-time cost for building the facility, their housing, and then for setting up their observation post at the actual factory. But they, of course, bear the costs of moving their people back and forth. And so the big cost is in preparing the sites and getting the housing built if necessary to do that. For a while, the Soviet inspectors were living in a condominium complex in Salt Lake City before their actual housing facility, separate housing facility, was built.
Has there been any thought that possibly the Soviets might be willing to trust us because we've got the media, we can hardly keep anything secret, and let us do the monitoring so as to get us to sign the treaty? We can verify, and they don't need to. Nobody, I suppose, has suggested that.
Well, nobody suggested that, but one former head of military intelligence for the Soviet Union suggested to me that they would be delighted if the United States would destroy not only our chemical weapons at Johnson Atoll, but also theirs, because they cannot get a chemical weapons destruction facility built in the Soviet Union. They had one completely built, and the local residents raised so much cane about the existence of this facility that they are just not going to be able to operate there. I was in the Soviet Union in October talking with people at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and just all across the board, and they're not really worried so much about the costs of monitoring these agreements. What they're really concerned about is what they're going to do with their economy if defense production drops off, because it's not like here where a defense contractor can lay off 2,000 people and they have unemployment insurance and the opportunity to migrate perhaps to some other area of the United States to look for work. In the Soviet Union, often the defense facility is the only game in town, and there's no housing to move to anywhere else. So they're in a very desperate search now of ways to convert their industry, defense factories, over to producing civilian goods, to produce something that's worth something on the export market, all in a time when they have an incredible shortage of hard currency to be able to buy the types of equipment they need to convert these industries. And so that, I mean, obviously they have to bear similar types of costs for inspections, but their peace dividend from all the arms control is very mixed blessing for them.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Wilson.
You know, I don't think I've ever heard a discussion so gently and intelligently presented concerning intercontinental nuclear weapons. It's most appropriate that you do so, because I've observed your presentation, and it's obvious to me and to this group that you're no pistol packing mama. There are two things that occurred to me while you were speaking. The expense of monitoring, which sounds to me abysmally small. But I have trouble in determining what small is in relation to what.
Mm-hmm.
if that money had been spent effectively on monitoring the dangerous situation in the SNL problem, it may have had more short-term benefit for our economy than monitoring arms. On the other hand, there is one aspect of this that I don't think it's difficult to quantify. I don't think it can be quantified, but I think it must be addressed in determining what's small and what's not. And that is, compared to what? Suppose nothing was done. Mm-hmm. What is the continuing cost of what we've been doing when apparently the motivation for hostilities has been substantially reduced on a philosophical basis? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's a grand point that you raise. I think one reason you've not heard so much about the INF treaty is because the political will was there to make it work. There was a lot of trepidation going into the implementation phase of the treaty, mostly on the part of Americans who were wondering how they would be received in the Soviet Union by the people there, escorting them for these inspections, if they would be obstructionists, mm-hmm. difficult to get along with, delaying them in access to the sites they were inspecting. And for the most part, it's been implemented incredibly smoothly because there was the political will to make it work. I think the idea that this is maybe a difficult adolescence, or at least an expensive adolescence that we're going through, may be tempered by the fact that with a few years of experience, we can perhaps not do 20 inspections a year just because we're given the opportunity in the treaty to do 20 inspections, that we can not exercise all of these opportunities. And for the most part, the treaties are written that way so that it doesn't say you must do or the parties will conduct X number. So I think as confidence grows, then we perhaps can reduce some of the costs associated with it by not pursuing all opportunities every time. I think we're going to see that fairly quickly in terms of the protocols for the implementation of the threshold test ban treaty. These are extremely complicated, even for a geologist lawyer to sit down and read. They go to the extreme of defining everything, including what a diode is, and it's an incredible document, very technical. The United States, under the testing agreement, has the opportunity to put in an extremely intrusive seismic monitoring apparatus called Cortex. Anytime the Soviet Union plans to do a test where the yield would be over 50 kilotons, they've estimated that it will cost approximately a tenth of the U.S. testing budget to monitor Soviet tests using this method. And if it indeed comes out of the Department of Energy's testing budget and comes out of monies they already have, not an increase in their budget, then I think you're going to see some internal pushes to reducing the number of observations. So rather than doing a very intrusive monitoring for years to come. I think perhaps after they've monitored just a few tests using this method, then they'll say, we have all the information that we think we need. We're not going to do that anymore. So there is some room in there to have options, not to exercise all of your inspection rights. So we may see a similar thing taking over with time, but it's going to have to come from I think really needing the push from the political side rather than from the technical community, because the technical community may be convinced much quicker than the politicians will be convinced that they are not going to be blindsided by some type of gross noncompliance.
Something like the SNL.
Mm.
General Kidd.
I'd like to add my appreciation for an extremely lucid briefing.
I appreciate that coming from you.
I have two, she'll shorten the answers because I have two questions, okay? The first one is, what's the United States going to do with all these used warheads?
Mm-hmm. You want me to go ahead and answer that one?
If you would, please.
All right. There's no provision for destruction of nuclear materials in the START agreement. Apparently, we are just going to store it, the nuclear materials. It could be removed from the warheads and used to make other warheads, but there is no provision for monitoring stockpiles or anything like that. And this was a question that came up during the INF treaty, at least during the ratification hearings, is that, you know, this is not destroying any warheads per se, but it was just seen as being too intrusive to actually provide for destruction of nuclear materials. I had a suggestion from someone last month that what they could do is take this extremely pure uranium and contaminate it with and make it useful for, you know, nuclear reactors, but completely unusable for nuclear warheads. So, but there's no provision for doing anything other than it will return to the nuclear stockpile of the two countries. So it's not a short answer at all. Okay.
Well, that was great. The second one, I note you've written on deterrence. And what would it take in today's situation, in terms of numbers of weapons, to deter the Soviets? Kind of the second facet of that is there any political will, or do you see the feasibility of a political decision to disarm unilaterally in the United States?
I don't think that we will ever see the United States disarm unilaterally. There may be some room. There have been some suggestions that as an alternative to these formalized complex agreements, that both sides just take unilateral actions. And to some extent, both sides have, saying that, you know, we're going to reduce chemical stocks of chemical weapons down to a certain level. But I don't think that the United States would ever unilaterally disarm or get rid of their nuclear weapons. It may be that we can reach some consensus on lower and lower and lower numbers of nuclear weapons, not only regarding the U.S. and Soviet Union, but also the other countries which have nuclear weapons. In some sort of an exchange with President Gorbachev, he indicated that, you know, five nuclear weapons falling on the Soviet Union would just be a disaster. So I think there's some ideas about going to extremely low numbers out on the horizon, but it's on the far horizon, and it's going to take a lot of consensus building, and I think over a long period of time, to reach very low levels in the arsenals.
Yes, Mr. Seymour.
What effect is being had on the disarmament control theorists by the possible disintegration, the economic disintegration, political disintegration of the Russian Empire?
Well, obviously when you have more than, it's complicated enough to have just two parties at the table. We've had a lot of concern, and one thing that I'm interested in is how do you accommodate true multilateral negotiations. In the past, it's been NATO, Warsaw Treaty. How do you accommodate the legitimate needs and desires of what is now dissolving there around the table? I think there's a sense of urgency to go ahead and try to get the Soviet Union to proceed with arms control agreements in anticipation, sort of as insurance against some sort of breakup. But not being a Soviet specialist, and perhaps none of the Soviet specialists really being Soviet specialists, it's hard to project how that would affect their foreign policy. I know that there have been some statements by different people in the republics about conducting their own foreign policy, but how that would relate to arms control negotiations, whether that would necessarily have a negative effect on arms control negotiations, is just too hard to figure at this time. It may help serve as a greater impetus for arms control, but it's because the proposals are so new, it's hard to see how it might affect their negotiating at during the current negotiations.
Has their problem become more complicated? Doesn't it reduce the importance of our problems? Doesn't it lessen our difficulties?
In what, our difficulties about what?
They will become less effective militarily as they disintegrate.
Mm.
If they become less effective militarily, doesn't that reduce our problems?
It would seem that there should be some sort of counter action here that would support that. Yeah.
Our speaker today has refuted three propositions. One, when General Elliott, who was playing hooky this morning, said we ought to get some younger speakers, we said, fine, but they won't know as much as the older speakers. And that's clearly a falsehood. Secondly, MacArthur Foundation, when it started this program of support to international security people, said they were especially interested in having people combine science and policy. And those of us who eke out a living by teaching straight international politics said, well, they won't know enough about international politics if they're mere scientists. And that's been proven to be a falsehood. Thirdly, oftentimes it's said that when somebody is realistic about arms control, then all hope goes out the window. But I think a lot of hope still remains, even as a result of this very realistic and hard-hitting presentation. So for having dissipated the falsehoods that lurk in the skies, why, we thank you very much.
Thank you so much.